This is still working, I'm assuming. The second of my three moments of upheaval is, of course, the raucous introduction of feminism into the art world canon. I don't have any slides of early feminism, so this is a later one of Women's Action Coalition from the 1990s. The feminist art movement hit New York hardest in the fall of 1970, although it was already going strong in California. One women's group had emerged from the Art Workers Coalition, but hadn't had much success in getting the museums to listen to them. So in 1970, four of us founded a new group, the Ad Hoc Women Artists Committee. Our first action was to protest the predominantly male Whitney Annual, then the most prestigious and supposedly representative exhibition of American art, in order to force the New York art institutions to recognize the number and the quality of women artists whom they'd always ignored, to visit women's studios, which would result in a far broader representation in major shows. Next. This is actually one of the original slides used in these protests. Our strategies were often conceptual. We faked a press release coming purportedly from the Whitney, proudly announcing that since the museum had been founded by a woman, it was only appropriate that the 1970 sculpture show would consist of 50% women and 50% non-white, as we quaintly put it. Thanks to our efforts and the Women's Art Slide Registry, the Whitney included four times as many women as they had before, though that wasn't enough. We also forged invitations to the opening so we could stage a sit-in inside the museum. And when they found out we were doing this, we traded our fake invitations with real ones to famous people like Robert Rauschenberg, and they couldn't not let him in, so we got in. We projected women's slides on the outside of the museum, a nice twist on site specificity. We demonstrated every weekend, we blew whistles in the stairwells, we conducted fake docent tours and interviews in the show, and the FBI was brought in to catch the criminals, which they were unsuccessful at. Next, please. This is a later piece also by the Guerrilla Girls who came out of this movement. Feminist art was an entirely different kind of assault on the art world than conceptual had been, ism had been. This time it was a matter of breaking down barriers not to get out of the art world, but to get in. A similar motive led me to spend much of the 1980s working with artists of color. Art forms by women initially appeared to be no different from those already accepted in the mainstream, and these were the artists who were first admitted into the market. Yet during the process, there emerged a number of forms and approaches that were clearly female and feminist, and thus unfamiliar and unacceptable. Next. This is by Annette Messager. The revolutionary aspect of the feminist art movement was that it opened up the art world to a whole range of expressive possibilities that had previously been denied entrance. The female body, the female lived experience proved to be shocking interventions. We actually managed to épater l'avant-garde. Next, please. This is by Carolee Schneemann. The issues of gender that informed the art of the 1980s and 90s began with the basic explorations in the 70s. The vaginal image became a powerful celebration instead of an insult. From Carolee Schneemann's willful narcissism to Judy Chicago's powerful abstractions. Next. Linda Benglis had herself photographed nude with a double dildo, pointing out not too subtly that if you had to have a penis to make it in the art world, it might as well be a big one. Next. Feminism's greatest contribution to art was precisely its lack of formal contributions to modernism. This is by Suzanne Lacy, one of her many public performance pieces. This one is called In Mourning and In Rage in 1977, about a murderer who was killing women. The feminist art offered no radical new ways of handling the picture plane or rearranging space or treating the surface and the edge of a canvas. But as inclusive structures or social collages, it rearranged the way art was seen. Autobiography, storytelling, artists' books, community arts, and activist performance were among the uses feminism found for some of the conceptual art strategies of the 1960s. Next, please. This is by Howardina Pindell, an African-American artist. Autobiography, Ancestry of Slavery, Water, Middle Passage, Family Ghosts. With the introduction of the mantra, the personal is political, came its counterpart, the political is personal, an analysis that helped artists explore the ways in which our private lives are formed by such apparently public issues as war, unemployment, inflation, racism, or the threat of nuclear holocaust. And we all know what that's like right now in the so-called financial crisis. This engendered the emancipatory notion that the changing self was the basis of social change, using personal histories, not necessarily one's own, to illuminate world events and larger vistas. Next, please. This is Suzanne Lacey again, a piece called, another performance dialogue piece called Freeze Frame, Room for Living. It was performed, but just, it wasn't a script or anything in a furniture showroom. All of her pieces always take place out of museums and so forth. And we learned that the personal is only political when the individual is seen as a member of the social whole. Perhaps the single aspect of feminist art that made it most foreign to the mainstream notion is that it's impossible to discuss it without referring to surrounding social structures. Next, please. This is by Adrian Piper. We were trying to divert the mainstream into many new tributaries, among them a public art that actually tried to communicate with the public. During this 1970s, I began to see my life as a collage, a form I've always loved since Dada was my art historical interest. You said we've had an art historical background. The collage aesthetic, also the core of postmodernity, is peculiarly feminist. Next, please. Collage is about relationships, juxtaposition and superimposition, gluing and ungluing. It's an aesthetic that dismantles the expected and accepts and rearranges it in ways that suggest what it could be. This is by Lorraine O'Grady. It was a piece performed within an African American Day parade in 1983, and she had a float with frames on it, and she and other artists dressed in white would jump off and frame people in the audience to show that both Harlem was a perfectly good place to have art, although it was not in the art world in that sense in those days, and that black people were perfectly good consumers of art and so forth and so on, obvious message. Collage makes something of contradictions, which are always healthy and rarely resolved. Montage or collage is also the medium of surprise, and surprise with conscious analysis behind it is a good political weapon. Next, please. And the third moment I want to consider was around the cusp of 1980, characterized by a new wave of collaborative art and activism. Collaboration, a prime component in feminism, is the social extension of the collage aesthetic. It's long been an antidote to the powerful sense of alienation that characterizes late capitalism, which divides and separates through specialization at the same time that it homogenizes. This is a piece, The Manifesto Show, by Colin. Putting things together without divesting them of their own identities is a metaphor for cultural democracy, the diametric opposite of a homogenizing global corporate culture. Next, please. This is the magazine Red Herring, which came out of a group called Artists Meeting for Cultural Change in the late 70s. A grassroots left cultural movement had been growing quietly from the plowed under mulch of 1960s activism. In 79 to 80, it was revitalized, and you realize I'm just talking about New York here because that's my lived experience. Then it was revitalized by an influx of belligerently disillusioned and or idealistic young artists, well-trained and ambitious, but dissatisfied by the narrowness and elitism of the art world in which they were supposed to blend seamlessly if they wanted to make it. Next, please. Again, the political zeitgeist was a catalyst. We were on the brink of Ronald Reagan's election as president of the United States. We thought that was as bad as it could get. We've learned better later. Pop culture had brought a second-rate actor to the White House. Could pop culture provide an antidote? A key factor in the development of a remodeled activist art in New York was punk, imported from the British working class and Americanized into a middle-class rebellion based in social alienation. This was by Michael Greer, this Ronald Reagan called Give Blood, was the centerpiece of a show that a couple of us put together at a union, District 1199. Next, please. At the same time, a complex merger of high and low culture was taking place, heir to both pop art and feminism, incorporating connections between art schools, rock music, anarchism, and the club scene. Temporary and diverse coalitions were formed between outrageous contemporary artists and the more conventional community art movement and oppositional art from the restless left. Next, please. Oh, I'm sorry, that last one was a piece by John Ahern, a wall piece that he did in the South Bronx where a lot of people were working at the time. Next. So this is a more conventional mural by Olivia Goody and A. Kinlana in Chicago called Where There Is Discord, Harmony, The Power of Art. So murals and public works were accepted as possible vehicles not only for social change but for cutting-edge art. And this was also something new. Next, please. This is a collaboration between Jenny Holzer and Lady Pink, who was a graffiti artist. It's called Tear Ducts Seem to Be a Grief Provision. Young artists teamed up with their peers in the ghettos, some of them graffiti writers. Together, they created a vital new milieu for art making across conventional borders. Rejecting the pristine spaces of Soho and the slick pages of the trade magazines, as well as the rugged individualist dog-eat-dog aspects of the art world, many younger artists got together as collaborative projects, better known as CoLab. Next, please. They had scruffy open theme shows in storefronts and derelict spaces, such as the notorious Times Square show in a former massage parlor. This is one shot from it. And the more socially attuned real estate show. They published raw, grainy newsprint zines, pioneering a chaotic aesthetic of display and independent distribution, what I called kind of the journalization of art. A lot of it was very gritty and gray, and it kind of looked like Depression, pre-World War II period art. Next, please. Group Material did this one. It's called Fascere, F-A-S-C-E-R-E, / fashion. So bringing together fashion and fascism, by implication. In 1978, Fashion Moda was founded in the South Bronx by Austrian expatriate Stefan Eins and the local Joe Lewis. It was not a community center or an avant-garde alternative space, but they called it a cultural concept, an exchange of energies. Another primarily black and Puerto Rican neighborhood, the Lower East Side of Manhattan, was home to other young collectives like Group Material and ABC No Rio. Group Material, which had somewhat more structured socialist politics, first opened a storefront, but later abandoned it for a freer strategy of street art and exhibiting in public places. They pioneered a fresh strategy in which the exhibition became a collective artwork, involving community members as well. World War III Comics, for instance, was deeply involved in the squatters movement on the Lower East Side. Next, please. Then there was PAD. Horrible name. Political Art Documentation Distribution. We thought it was going to be an archive, and so we named it this thing. The most overtly leftist group of the period. And it began with an archive of internationally socially engaged art, which ironically ended up at the Museum of Modern Art Library. PAD organized exhibitions in peculiar places, such as public bathrooms and telephone booths, and published a little magazine called Up Front, and collaborated with other organizations to make political demonstration art. Next. Printed Matter, an artist's bookstore below Canal Street, featured window pieces on political issues aimed at passersby. Next. Art Against Apartheid, the Alliance for Cultural Democracy, and later ACT UP, the wildly successful LGBT group, among others, also interacted and collaborated. Heresies, the feminist journal on art and politics, was part of the mix. Next. So was Artist's Call Against U.S. Intervention in Central America, a national campaign that organized some 30 shows in New York City alone in 1984. That's the Klaus Oldenburg poster for Artist's Call. It's up at the top. It's sort of a banana monument being pulled down. Next is... As part of this outreach and rejection of art world values, sleaze itself became a style, a welcome respite from the slick fare of the Soho galleries, but sometimes questionable in its politics or lack thereof. Irony became the easiest way to engage, or rather not to engage, with real politics. There was a kind of scary implication that art could be political merely by showing generalized hostility, a gun, a black face, pornography, a dollar sign, rather than by engaging directly with the issues. Some of this art, and some of it was by women, was misogynistic in ways that were hard for older feminists like me to understand. I called it retro-chic, and feared that it was feeding into the right wing's fury. And of course it did. It led in part to the culture wars of the later 1980s. I wrote that the danger lay not so much in retro-chic's direct effect on the art audience as in its acceptance by the art world itself, where it could become a model for other ambitious artists without the anti-establishment iconoclasm that sparked the initiators. Next, please. This is by Barbara Kruger. That happened, of course, in a few cases, but for the most part, these artists from the collaborative period who became art world stars, Jenny Holzer, Barbara Kruger, and Cindy Sherman, for example, emerged from this period with their critical faculties intact. Next, please. This is by Jean-Michel Basquiat. By the mid-1980s, all this energy was being noticed by the institutions. Mainstream galleries and museum curators who had never bothered to make the trip to multicultural strongholds, such as the Studio Museum in Harlem, the Asian American Cultural Center in Chinatown, or the American Indian Community House and the Museum of Contemporary Hispanic Art on the edges of Soho, now began to go out of their way, literally, to see some of this hot new art, of course, just as it was cooling down and becoming accepted into academia. Next, please. This is a street piece by Charles Simmons from the early 70s. So, and he actually worked in Paris at one point, he worked in Bellevue sometime in the 70s. So in conclusion, all of these moments prove that art can work as an organizing tool and that co-optation is never far behind when artists spawn a truly vital scene. At some point in every movement, the mainstream moves in and seduces enough artists that the steam goes out of the movement. It's not always clear if the art is co-opted by the institutions or the institutions are co-opted by the artists. The burnout rate for activist artists is high because the rewards are minimal and usually severed from the expected art world perks. On the other hand, I'm a great believer in the benefits of lived experience. Any artist who has worked outside the confines of the art world, as Charles did, whether or not she eventually chooses to make oppositional art her life work, is changed in some way. Once beyond the safety of home base, where artists are trained to act, much can be learned about the world, about art, and about oneself and one's art. Next, please. This is by Natasha Mayers. It's a demonstration piece, Fiddling While the World Burns. The increased political sophistication of some 1980s artists compared to 1960s conceptualism and the gradual development of left culture in the U.S. is striking, though political naivete is still a hallmark or perhaps a tool of the art world. Increased sophistication often brings with it increased cynicism about the power of culture to make real change. Despite grassroots outrage and art against the Iraq War, for instance, which received little or no media attention. Next, please. Disillusionment and powerlessness have remained the norm during the disastrous Bush administrations. Next. That was done right after 9/11. This is by Ilona Granat. The cross-disciplinary DIY or do-it-yourself movement that's being rediscovered today in very different contexts by a much younger global generation was an integral element of all my three moments. I'm heartened by the increase of young transnational collectives working today to combat climate change and pockets of fascism. The whole point of conceptualism is precisely the notion of doing it ourselves, bypassing mainstream institutions by having an idea and then directly, independently acting upon it. In each of these moments, you just did what you could with what was at hand. Dematerialization made art making cheap and easy. Working in the public domain means no rent and overhead. This model is carried through later decades and later movements, and I think Target Autopop is definitely working in those lines. Next, please. This is the last slide. It's by Houston Lada. It was done in the basement of an abandoned high school in the South Bronx. And it's an amazing piece because it's 3-point perspective, 1-point perspective. Anyway, the creature, the thing, hombre de piedra, you wouldn't see him if you moved a little to one way or the other. It's done by dots. So it's just a bunch of dots until you stand in the right place and the whole figure comes together. We had to go down into this deep, dank, horrible place to see it. But it was definitely public and nobody was controlling it. So from these moments in the last 4 decades, it's possible to conclude that the strongest activism, whether aimed at the art world or the real world, starts from a center, a specific location, from a deep map, from consciously lived experience, then moves on out from there in a series of ripple effects. Because artists are complicitous in the way the world is seen, art isn't any different from life when it comes to ethics. But art isn't life, you may argue. Every situation is loaded and labyrinthine. But art has a kind of permanent innocence in this culture. We expect very little of it, we expect everything of it, depending on who we are. The real problem is that art itself has no genuine context in this society. It glides across these minimal expectations, but it's good for something. My favorite line on this comes from Fluxus artist Robert Filliou, when he said, "Art is what makes life more interesting than art." Thank you.